It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It has been a sunny and dry start to the summer season in Wisconsin. So when you reach for that sunscreen, do you know what the active ingredients do and how to get the most protection from UV rays? Join in the conversation about sunscreen. Call in with a question, a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kelly Dobos is a cosmetic chemist and adjunct professor of cosmetic science at the University of Cincinnati. Kelly, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. It's great to be here and talk about this important topic of sunscreens.
Yes, so the American Academy of Dermatology says some phrases that we see on sunscreen packaging can be misleading. Words like reef safe and chemical free, non-toxic. What do you think of these terms on labels?
Sure. I'll start with, as a chemist, one of my favorite topics is the chemical-free claim. And, all of the ingredients in sunscreens are chemicals. Basically, a chemical is any compound that's made up of atoms. So it's a little misleading to refer to them as chemical-free because they're all chemicals. And that kind of gets further complicated when we try to describe them as mineral or physical blockers compared to chemical blockers as well, because the term mineral implies something is natural, and zinc oxide and titanium dioxide are certainly not natural in the form they're used in cosmetics. They have to be either synthesized or processed very heavily to make them safe for use in these products. And they're not exactly 100% physical blockers of sun either. There is some absorption happening. So it gets complicated when we try to simplify the classification of these materials.
I think that's a really important distinction when we see the word sun block. When I think of a block, nothing's getting through it, Kelly. And so when you mineral sunblock made with titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, can you explain the difference between the word sunscreen and sunblock?
According to the United States FDA, which regulates sunscreens as an OTC drug, you can't actually use the word sunblock anymore because, as you stated, there's no 100% protection from the sun. So sunblock is actually a term that you can't use on labeling anymore for sunscreen products. Sunscreen products have to be labeled with an SPF, and that tells us the amount of protection you're getting from UVB rays. And now they have to also be labeled in terms of how much UVA protection they're providing. And that comes in with the broad spectrum claim. So we have to have some comparable level of UVA protection to our SPF in order to make that broad spectrum claim as well.
How much latitude do manufacturers have on their terminology? I mean, we're talking about broad spectrum and these other terms, SPF, that you see on labels and you're trying to use as a playing field leveler, if you will. How much latitude do the makers have with what is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration in terms of the terminology?
Sunscreens are regulated as an OTC drug, and that means that they have to follow the labeling guidelines from the FDA with regards to things like SPF and the types of claims they can make and how they lay out the ingredients. The active ingredients have to be at the top of the list in a section that identifies them as active ingredients. And the SPF number and the UVA claim, those are taken from results of testing. So there are specific procedures and that have to be followed to test the product in order to make those claims. So it's very strict in terms of passing that test before you can make the claim. And that SPF number is calculated from the SPF test as well. So there's not a lot of latitude in what they can claim with regards to SPF and UVA protection. And the other claims that you can make with a sunscreen in fact, you know, protection from skin cancer. That claim is also tied to the type of testing and results you get as well. So those are very tightly controlled by the U.S. FDA.
Tightly controlled by the FDA. Talking about sunscreen ingredients, the packaging, the marketing, Kelly Dobos here, cosmetic chemist. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. So, Kelly, what does organic mean on sunscreen packaging?
This is an interesting one from a chemist perspective. When we talk about organic chemistry, we're talking about the chemistry of molecules that contain carbon-carbon or carbon-hydrogen bonds.
Oh, you mean the class I couldn't pass, right?
It's also known as, right? And I still remember that my organic class and how tough it was. So that's what we chemists define as organic. But in the consumer mindset, it's come to mean you know, materials that are grown without the use of pesticides. So there's a different definition to organic in the consumer mindset. So we chemists define organic sunscreen actives as those that contain those carbon-carbon, carbon-hydrogen bonds as compared to the inorganic, which means these chemicals don't have any carbon bonds, and those are the titanium dioxide and zinc oxide. And those are the clearest definitions for us to describe these sunscreen active ingredients when it comes to the chemistry of them. But it gets a little confusing for the consumer when they are familiar with the term organic as it relates to things they buy at the grocery store.
Indeed, yes. So let's enter the Environmental Working Group here, releasing their first ever list of verified sunscreens. The group is the nonprofit of scientists, advocates researching healthcare products and legislation. Do you think our third-party verification seals valuable?
When it comes to groups like the Environmental Working Group, they obviously have good intentions with what they're trying to do, but we often, as scientists, find some of the ways they're making these determinations to be a little bit questionable. And some of the studies that they rely on for safety may not really apply to the particular actual route of exposure of the material or how it's actually formulated into a product. Because some of these studies, these toxicology studies they look at, might focus on a single ingredient used at a very high level that isn't really representative of how a chemical is going to be used in a cosmetic or OTC drug type product.
But then are there other groups or other organizations in the consumer's camp that are watching out for consumers beyond regulators?
What I would look to are groups like the Skin Cancer Foundation, and they have a lot of great information on sun protection, sun SPF products, and all of that information is readily available online. And another great resource for sunscreen information is the American Academy of Dermatology. So I would look to these groups for information as well.
Okay, so some cosmetic products are really multitasking. They include sunscreens like face moisturizers and bug sprays. Are these types of products, these 3-in-1, 4-in-1s, an effective way to protect skin from the sun?
Any product that makes a SPF claim has to pass the same testing as a beach product would. So they are held to the same standard, and they should, by meeting the requirements of the test, they should be equivalent to a beach-type product. They often may be lower SPF if it's a multitasking product, because when we're trying to combine all of these different ingredients and chemistries, it might be harder to achieve that a high level of SPF, something like a 50 or a 60 in a like a makeup-type product.
My concern is if you apply the sunscreen a lot, like you should, and you apply insect repellent sparingly and less often, is that a good combination?
One of the examples I'll think about it is a makeup product, right, with a sunscreen. You're not going to be applying that every 2 hours as you should with a sunscreen product. Right. So you shouldn't be relying on that product for your primary source of sun protection. So these are good maybe adjuncts to your your typical sunscreen, but they shouldn't be relied on as your primary, because like I said, nobody's going to be reapplying their foundation every 2 hours, and that is the recommendation for sunscreens, is to ensure that you reapply every 2 hours, because we sweat, we're moving, we might be rubbing some of the sunscreen off. So you want to be sure you're reapplying every 2 hours when you're exposing yourself to the sun.
Cosmetic chemist Kelly Dobos, our guide to the ingredients in sunscreen, the chemistry, how to read these labels. You can be part of this discussion and share how you protect yourself from harmful rays. Call in with a question, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how to discern the ingredients in sunscreen, chemicals of concern on sunscreen labels, and the terminology used for effectiveness. Waterproof, sweatproof, sweat-resistant, non-toxic. Join in at any point about these products. Call in with a question about sunscreen you use or wonder about, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have cosmetic chemist Kelly Dobos with us. So, Kelly, the known carcinogen called benzene is found in some sunscreens, and benzene never intentionally added as an ingredient, according to the Cleveland Clinic. How does benzene find its way into sunscreen?
The benzene that we've seen stories about in the news was really linked to the propellants used in some of the aerosol-type sunscreen. So it was a trace contaminant in that particular part of the product. So, you know, if you're really looking to ensure you're avoiding potential benzene, you can look to use the cream or lotion type format products instead of the aerosols. And the benzene that the levels of benzene are very low trace levels. And what I would say is that we're continuously exposed to benzene in our environment from other sources, from, you know, when you're pumping gasoline. If you smoke, that is a really high concentration of benzene. So even though it is concerning that this benzene has been found in the propellant, I'd caution people not to get too concerned over the benzene, and know that the companies who discovered benzene in their products have worked very diligently to identify the source of the contamination and help remove it from their product. So that's work that is continuing to be done. So
a little bit more of the chemical discerning here. There's also oxybenzone and avobenzone, and then PABA, the para-aminobenzoic acid. What can you tell us about those chemicals?
So these different sunscreen active ingredients are often used in combination in a product to give you that broad spectrum coverage, because each of the ingredients has a little bit different area of the spectrum that they might cover. And so that's why we tend to use a combination of these materials. PABA has become known as an allergen to the skin, and it's actually not used anymore in any sunscreen formulation. So when it became known that there's the potential for allergenicity with this material, it started to be removed from products, and that I'd say be hard-pressed to find any sunscreen using that material today.
What is the difference between an allergen and an irritant in products?
This is a very interesting question. And when something is an allergen, it's an immune response in your skin, compared to an irritant, which is a more, what I would say is that if something is an irritant, everyone will be irritated by the material. And if something's an allergen, it's going to be an individual specific response. So they're different in their mechanisms of how these reactions happen in the skin. And so an allergen, because it's in more individual specific, I might be allergic to a particular fragrance and you might not. So it can be very hard for a company to make a product that is completely non-allergenic to everyone. So that's why they use the term hypoallergenic on products. Hypoallergenic means that a product has been tested with a large number of subjects to ensure that it's less allergenic than normal. So they're able to make that claim by doing that testing. And, you know, it's important to remember that hypoallergenic doesn't mean non-allergenic. It just means less than.
Talking about sunscreen ingredients with Kelly Dobos, cosmetic chemist, you can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Rory is here from Chippewa Falls. Rory, hi.
Hi. I'm 73 years old, and I've had melanomas and basal cells, and a lot of precancerous basal cells. And a lot of that's because I've got red hair and blue eyes. So I've got really white skin. But I think people have to be aware that the sunblock or sunscreen doesn't cover everything. And they're probably better off if they can to wear long clothing, especially if they're going to be out for a long time, because the sun gets blocked out a lot better that way.
Rory, thank you so much for that. And Kelly, such an important point there that sunscreens and sunblock aren't perfect. They don't do it all.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the complications with sunscreen is that sometimes they don't feel so great or they don't look so great on the skin. And that can be a barrier to people using it as often as they should or reapplying as often as they should. So sun avoidance is a great way to protect yourself as well. You know, one thing I always caution people against is tanning is, you know, purposefully tanning, whether it's in a sun or in a tanning bed, is really dangerous. And that is something that, you know, we shouldn't be doing, because we should be, the tanning response is actually, you know, a sign of damage to our skin. So
we heard from Beth in Milton, has a question about oxybenzone. Beth says, we have well water and products will make your clothes turn orange. And Beth wears black to the beach to avoid the staining. What is the chemical composition that could be causing that? Beth asks.
Sometimes some of the ingredients and the combination with the sweat or sebum from your skin can discolor clothing. You know, sunscreens are complex mixtures, so sometimes you're not exactly sure which particular ingredient could be the source of the problem. But it's often sometimes the mixture of the chemicals in the sunscreen with your sweat that tend to discolor clothing.
What you mentioned fragrances earlier. What about the added fragrances to these sunscreens and sensitive skin, but also, do you know, sometimes people say, oh, that sunscreen smells like summer. I'm just wondering how much added fragrance is there?
When it comes to the active ingredients in sunscreens, they may have a characteristic odor to them. And it's often that we use fragrance to try and cover up some of what we call the base odor in products. So if you're looking for a sunscreen to be lower irritation or less, you know, hypoallergenic, you want to look for something that is fragrance-free, because fragrance is often the driver of allergic response when it comes to cosmetic products. But some of the sunscreen active ingredients have their own characteristic odor, and, you know, that's just inherent to the material itself. And so sunscreens do have some odor on their own, even if it might be fragrance-free.
So when we are in the aisle with all that sunscreen, all those different products, we only have a few seconds left, though. What is the most important question we should ask ourselves before we go and purchase that bottle?
look for a broad spectrum and an SPF of at least 15 or higher. I would say 30. It should be the minimum. And, you know, there are so many products out there. You want to find the one that you're going to use. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the best sunscreen for you, the one that you will use the most often. And that can vary for every different consumer. So find the one that works for you.
Kelly, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was great to talk to you.
Kelly Dobos is a cosmetic chemist with expertise in skincare product formulations. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Millions of workers first experienced remote work during the pandemic, and today, as many as 40% of workers nationally say they do at least some of their work from home. Gabby Vinnick explores the work-from-home economy.
Are you a good girl?
Yes, you are. You're a good girl, Bee.
On a sunny Friday afternoon, Laura Isaacson's dog, Bee, wants to play. After a few pets for her chocolate lab, Isaacson sits back at her computer at the kitchen table. She's surrounded by bookshelves, and she has light shining through the windows of her home in Mount Horeb. It's a different experience than her time working as a dietitian for the last 20 years. She would often drive to and from the hospital in the dark. Her commute took roughly 30 minutes to Dodgeville. Now, Isaacson works from home as a diabetes care and education specialist for a San Francisco-based company. She's one of more than 400,000 remote workers in Wisconsin.
I am so much happier right now. I don't think I even realized before how stressed out I was. Trying to balance being a mom and working full-time outside of the house.
Isaacson is one of millions of people who first worked remotely during the pandemic. Today, as many as 40% of workers nationally say they do at least some of their work from home. There are signs that some plan to return to the office. In April, a morning consult poll found nearly half of U.S. employees prefer working in person. And a Pew Research survey in March found that remote workers tend to say it hurts their opportunities to be mentored. But Isaacson says she has no immediate plans to return to the office, and working from home has given her more flexibility.
That's something I think a lot of moms struggle with. You feel really guilty trying to find that balance. And for me, the flexible schedule, not having a start time or an end time, and just being able to work when it works for me and works for my family, huge difference.
In Mineral Point, Rachel Bergstrom speaks with the client on Zoom from a small room in her farmhouse.
Yeah, Friday afternoons are really flexible for me after 2, so.
She's an education consultant for a Texas-based company. Not long ago, this meeting would have been impossible. She says their Wi-Fi would not have been stable enough to run. But in recent years, millions of federal and state dollars have gone to expanding broadband access in Wisconsin. It now reaches more than 90% of state residents. That infrastructure has helped Bergstrom connect with colleagues all across the country. For her, remote work meant an end to years of leaving her home at 5 a.m. She had to wake up early to catch a ride on the state van pool to her job with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. In all, she spent about 3 hours on the road.
I don't know that I coped with the commute. I think it took a bigger toll on me than I realized now that I have more time to think.
Jose Maria Barrero is a finance professor and co-founder of the nationally recognized Work From Home Research Project. He says a relatively low-cost state like Wisconsin could be a winner in the work-from-home economy.
I think Wisconsin is interesting in that it is a state that has both large urban areas and a lot of rural areas. And so I think it has an opportunity to perhaps decongest the congested parts of the state.
Barrero says if rural areas have greater access to high-income workers, that could be a boon for local economies. But more work from home also means less foot traffic to urban downtowns, which creates its own challenges. Back in Mineral Point, Bergstrom says she hopes remote work possibilities benefits small towns like hers.
Maybe kids will stay in their small towns more because they can find a job programming, or they can find a job in an industry that's really booming, even if there's not a huge company here that does that.
Remote work is already shaping policy in new ways for Wisconsin, and Bergstrom is one of thousands who has no plans to get back to the office. Gabby Vinnick, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine ways to curb teen substance use as vaping products and cannabis edibles become more accessible. What drug and vaping prevention strategies are underway in Wisconsin? Call in with your question. Share thoughts on teen substance use at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Megan Tim is SSM Health Regional Director of Community Health. Megan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So earlier this spring, the Monroe County Sheriff's Office reported more teens and children as young as 8 in possession of marijuana and vaping devices, and an 18-year-old was arrested for supplying drugs to students. Are you finding more teens and younger children with these drugs?
Unfortunately, I have to say yes. I've been privileged to be able to be in some of our local middle schools across southern Wisconsin, speaking with middle school students about vaping nicotine as well as marijuana. And I've found that there are sixth graders raising their hand when asking them if they have ever tried a vape device, if they've ever experimented or felt the pressure to utilize these products. And I'm always a little shocked when I see, you know, an 11-year-old raise their hand saying, but it's not the first time. And so I do, the news was not necessarily shocking to me working with youth in the middle schools, knowing that there's an increased trend of our younger and younger students using these products.
What's behind that? What is behind this increased accessibility of electronic cigarette use or vaping among these young children?
Yeah, that's the question, right? So when, again, I like to go to the source. I think sometimes as adults, when we're in this space, we make a lot of assumptions about our youth and the why they are using these products. And I think a lot of times we go back into our history and think, what happened? What were we pressured to do when we were, you know, in middle school? And so it feels like we've talked a lot about the peer pressure, about the social norm around vaping. And though there is an aspect to that, when I speak to students, specifically students that are using THC in their vape devices, it's not necessarily a peer pressure moment. It is more of a coping device. And that's honestly a little bit more terrifying to me, that our middle schoolers are feeling that they need a method of coping for different mental health issues, whether that be anxiety, depression, home life, ACEs scores, right? That's something I talked to some of the students about. And I'm happy to speak more about that this morning. But you know, what have you experienced in your life that you are looking for a coping device while you're in the middle school, when you are at that age? And when we have older siblings perhaps getting access to them or parents utilizing them, they're often found on counters amongst other spaces. They're not often disposed of well, and that increases access. We also have, you can probably drive through any town in Wisconsin and see a new vape shop that's gone up in the last several years or few years even. And just that increase of exposing our youth to access to those things. You can have laws all day that say 21 and up, or, you know, eliminating, clearly not allowing middle schoolers to get access to a vape device. But we know that the access is just tremendous, and there's not a lot of measures on that right now. So our students are having a lot of free access to these things.
I want to go further into ACEs, but, you know, adverse childhood experiences and the mental health component here. But can vaping nicotine or vaping cannabis, can it worsen depression and anxiety or situations, or interfere with socializing at school and the emotional experiences?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. When looking at some recent research, it's been noted that those that vape nicotine first, right, have a 3.5 times, they're 3.5 times more likely to use cannabis if vaping nicotine. And so often they'll use their vape devices to utilize both products then. So 3.5 times more likely. And I think it's a perception issue. So our youth have a perception that THC and marijuana are more natural of products. And so when we use that term natural, just like with our food, right? Our students are assuming that it's okay. And the perception is that it's not a harmful product. We have seen that there is an increase of inflammation in the pulmonary system for those that are smoking THC. But the perception of our youth is that it increases their focus and it reduces anxiety, which allows them to communicate better in school. Now, I'm not a teacher, but I have to assume some of our teachers probably would not agree with that. But there is this perception of natural products going into their body and that it's actually reducing their stress. Now, we know with nicotine products that it actually increases stress on the body. It's not just something that causes addiction anymore. We know that it causes harmful physical attributes to our body as well. So I think it's this idea that it's a healthier product and therefore students feel like it's reasonable to try it out and see if it does in fact support their anxiety concerns or helps them focus better at school.
You teach Janesville students about the short-term and the long-term effects of using THC, the main psychoactive compound in marijuana, as well as in nicotine products, the effects of those. What are those risks for youth as they see, like, cannabis edibles and, you know, things with THC in so many places in the consumer marketplace?
Yeah, in Wisconsin, you know, we don't have legalization of things. So I often tell students, you don't actually know what's in these products because they're not being regulated. And so that's it. That's step one, right? It's not, I always start my conversations with youth on a level of respect, saying, it's not my body, it's yours. You have to make the choice, but you have to make an educated choice. So let's talk about that. And so I think that it's allowing students to explore the research themselves to understand where we're at. And up until last year, which was very exciting, but in 2022, July of last year, a new act was passed, the Research Expansion Act, which was passed by bipartisan legislators to support the research of marijuana in THC. You know, when it's federally, it's not legal. It's really hard to understand the impacts of it, especially with youth. Of course, our vulnerable population. We don't allow studies in that space, right? And so that act has helped get some energy around the need for more research to be done on marijuana and the impact of the body in our youth. So you're right. I have the privilege of being with middle schoolers in the Janesville area who have been very open in telling about their experiences and their ability to access. And, you know, I ask how many of you walk to school and walk past a vape shop or a store that sells these devices, and 50% of the students will raise their hand. And so we don't necessarily have ordinances and things in place that eliminate the amount of vape shops close to a youth building, for example, or in proximity to a youth building to help reduce that exposure. As we know, the more advertising and exposure to these products, the more likely students are to try them on for size.
So is vaping then a gateway into further substance use?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I hadn't necessarily thought about it like that. You know, when I think about gateway drugs, I think about, I'm 36, I think about my high school days in prevention of drug use. And when the research says 3.5 times more likely to use cannabis, I kind of keep to that language rather than gateway. I don't think that every single student that is trying out a vape is going to move to harder, more illicit drugs necessarily in their future. But I do think it opens up the door when you can use the same device to utilize both things. And so when you can interchange using THC in your vape device as well as nicotine, it creates an easiness almost for students to be able to utilize those. And again, I often speak to students about brain development and what are those choices really meaning? Is it a small choice or a big choice to make to choose to try these products? It might feel like a small choice in the moment, but in reality, when you're making this decision, it has lifelong impacts on the addiction piece. So in regards to if I think it's a gateway, I think it opens up the door for potential further use of cannabis or experimentation.
Megan Tim with us, Regional Director of Community Health at SSM Health, breaking down prevention and intervention strategies amid the availability of vape pens. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts about substance use in young people. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig deeper into adolescent substance use and intervention strategies as nicotine vaping is one of the top forms of substance use among teens, and researchers say it could be a gateway to other dangerous habits. Call in with questions and thoughts at any point about teen drug use, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Megan Tim is here, SSM Health Regional Director of Community Health. Let's take a call now. Cassie is with us in St. Francis. Cassie, hi, go ahead.
Hi, I just had to comment that when I was in middle school and high school, we didn't use vape pens or like pipes or anything. We used like apples and soda cans. And to me, it's not about what's available, you're just going to find it. It's about what the kid is lacking, right? Like we were lacking the support we needed. We were lacking strong parental figures who are willing to listen to us and other resources like that for the youth. And so to me, it's more like if the kid is missing out something, they're going to try to fill it in any way they can, and they're going to use whatever they can. So like vapes aren't like the, you know, the end all be all. They're going to do it regardless is my comment.
Cassie, thank you. Megan, go ahead.
Cassie, I so appreciate your comment, and I could not agree more with what you just said. It is really filling that void, and you're right. I was reflecting briefly as well about what are those things that you do when, as an adult, when you reflect back, and agreed, right? You're going to find a mechanism to cope or to fill the void that you're finding. And so I think you're spot on, and what a beautiful segment into resources for our youth. If we're looking at what's available for our youth, if you are, you know, some students are into athletics or into the extracurriculars and can fill that void with and social time. And others don't necessarily have that support, whether that be at home or with friends, or perhaps they've moved to several schools and they haven't built that network of support. And so we need to be better about making sure that no kid is left behind, honestly. And that's a difficult task when teachers are asked to be social workers and all the other things upon being a teacher. And so I think you're spot on, Cassie. We need more supports and identification of when those students have those gaps so we can fill it with something more productive and more positive.
From your viewpoint, are there enough substance use counselors in our schools to educate students about the problems with drugs and alcohol, and then also identify and support the kids with substance use disorders?
Yeah, I think that there's always going to be a more of a need for that support. And what I found coming from a healthcare system into the schools, what I've heard from both staff and honestly students who are more open to speaking to me about things than they are teachers. And that's not to the fault of school staff, right? There's just a trust gap there, perhaps, with wanting to share all of your intimate details on why you're using a substance as a youth. But coming out from the outside and being from a separate entity and not being seen as an authority figure to these youth, they open up and they do want to share. They do want to talk about it, and they want to understand it more, and they want to be a part of the solution. And so asking more substance use staff at schools to get involved, I'm not sure we would actually get down to students opening up with actual staff at the school. It really takes the whole community to better support these students and not just the schools and school districts.
Talking about youth possessing nicotine products, vape products, cannabis edibles, Megan Tim with us, the SSM Health Regional Director of Community Health. Let's take a call. Sean now in Eau Claire. Sean, hi.
Hello there. I'm Sean. I'm a hemp grower, actually, in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And one of the big concerns for me is hemp and cannabis really is a medicine. It can have, both can offer many benefits to people under the right conditions. What is scary, however, is the D9s, the HHCs, all these other cannabinoids that they're enhancing products with and adding to these vapes that can be, people can get easily in an unregulated market. When I was a teenager, the gateway for me was alcohol and cigarettes. The truth of the matter is cannabis has kept me and many, many other people from harder drugs. And the black market really doesn't care if they sell drugs to your children. Whereas a regulated market where people could lose their businesses, lose their license, and be out in the open where they can directly face charges for distributing to minors it's just preventative to the safety of our children to have the black markets. If we bring all this out into the forefront, we're more likely to keep our children safe.
Sean, thank you. I want to be able to get Megan to respond here about, you know, how easily someone, a youth, can get into an unregulated market space here with these products.
Yeah, Sean, thank you for that. I agree in the sense that students, the regulations are helpful, right? And in helping provide more guidance and structure around these things. And you're right. Vape companies, you know, nicotine and vape companies at this point have not discriminated against advertising to our youth. In fact, they were just charged $435 million for that. So you're right. They don't necessarily care if your youth are getting access. And in fact, they're actually gaining quite the benefit from it. And so I agree. I think having some level of regulation and the access piece is you're right. When they can get, you know, someone locally who's making things in their basement, for example, that's easier to get access to because there's no one is monitoring that situation, as opposed to in the market where folks are fearful of losing a license, like you mentioned, or abiding by the rules of the process of growing and providing and distributing. I think, unfortunately, as Patsy mentioned earlier, students will get access to things that they want, and they'll find a way to get it.
Well, Megan, thank you so much for joining us and shining a light on your work as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
Megan Tim is Regional Director of Community Health at SSM Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.